Counsel, this is the case of Moscoso versus Curtis. I apologize if I've mispronounced any names. Is it Ms. Wolf? You may approach. And Ms. Ayers, are you here as appellee counsel? Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Ms. Wolf, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Megan Wolf, and I represent the appellant Lauren Curtis, who is also present in court today. This is an appeal from the District Court of Douglas County, Nebraska, in which a non-married couple, the appellee, initially filed for sole legal and physical custody of the minor children. At the time of trial, Amelia was 7 and Eli was 5. Defendant appellant filed a counterclaim requesting joint legal and primary physical custody of the minor children. She asked that her residency take place in Iowa rather than Nebraska. Ultimately, this request was denied and the court ordered joint legal, joint physical custody of the minor children. Appellant thereby requests that this court reverse the findings after reviewing the case de novo and award her primary physical custody of the minor children. In our appeal, we identified three assignments of error. The first one is that the district court abused its discretion in applying an improper and heightened burden of proof to the appellant, Lauren Curtis, regarding her request for custody. This is an initial custody determination and not a dissolution or a modification. Therefore, the issue before the court was not simply whether she had the right to remove the children, but rather which parent should be awarded custody in the first place. Post-trial, the court made several findings.
So what do you think, whose burden was it to do what?
When it comes to the burden, Your Honor, we believe that it's simply the best interest argument. Basically, an initial custody determination, both parents have the burden to show that best interest of the children would be possession with them.
Can't we read the order in this case as applying that very standard?
No, Your Honor. As stated in Coleman v. Kaler, this is an issue where the children were born out of wedlock and there was no prior custody determination. Therefore, the removal jurisdiction does not apply to this case.
Right, but I understood you to say that this traditional removal rule doesn't apply here. It's just a best interest of the child standard. And each parent offers evidence of the best interest of the child. Your client was saying it's in their best interest to move. And why can't we read the court's ruling as saying, I disagree?
Well, Your Honor, the court did disagree with our finding. However, that's why we're asking for it to be reversed.
I understood you to be saying the court applied the wrong burden.
Correct.
And I'm saying, isn't there another way to read the court's order?
Your Honor, I do not believe that there is another way to read the court's order. Thank you.
Do you think, I beg your pardon, this is Judge Miller-Lerman. When the judge said she failed to meet her burden, what does that suggest to you? That she had a burden, is that correct? As in, if it had been a true removal, right, not an initial event, she would have had a burden, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So should we be reading out she failed in her burden to mean we, what I really mean is she they, you know, he said this and she said that, and here I go, here's my order.
Your Honor, the court specifically stated that she failed to meet her burden for removal. And I think that is what's crucial here, is that the court specifically looked at removal instead of just looking at this as an initial custody determination. And I do not believe that there was sufficient evidence to satisfy that plaintiff had met his burden to show that the children's best interest would be to reside with him in Nebraska. And that is our second assignment of error, which we believe that the court failed in addressing the proper factors that fit the best interests of the children. This year, the court decided Korth v. Korth, which despite being a dissolution and a true removal case, gave us some additional direction when looking at the best interests of the children. This was motive, quality of life, and impact on the contact between the child or children and the non-custodial parent. There's a few things here that I would like to highlight, especially when it comes to motive here. Ms. Curtis is not seeking to frustrate Mr. Moscoso's parenting time with the minor children. There's no evidence of that. There's no claim of denial of parenting time. Rather, she testified to numerous reasons for wishing to leave the state and for believing it was in the children's best interest to do so. She discussed the financial aspects of the new proposed residence in Northwest Iowa. Her new husband manages and owns hog barns up there, and there was testimony at trial that those hog barns produced over $168,000 in income, whereas there was testimony in Omaha she did not have the flexibility that this job provided, and also it's a serious income increase in income. Also, as stated, she did remarry in September, and that was on the record. And as the court stated in Boyer, remarriage is a significant and legitimate reason for removal.
And I want to go back to the issue of who bears a burden in child custody litigation. When one party is asserting, I want custody, and another party is asserting, no, I want custody, don't both parties bear a burden of persuasion for their particular claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
So to say that one party did or did not sustain a burden of proof does not necessarily mean anything more than you did not persuade me that you are the one who should have custody under the best interest standard. Isn't that correct?
Correct. However, the difference here is I believe that when the court made the record and made its findings, it specifically stated she has not met her burden to move. The court did not say she has not met her burden to show that it is in the children's best interest for her to be primary caregiver. They said she didn't meet her burden to move. The kids aren't moving. End of story.
I beg your pardon, so that we're all focused on the same language in paragraph 4. Right of the order, it says in number 4 in caps, removal. The defendant has failed to meet her burden, and the children are not permitted to be removed from the state of Nebraska. Nebraska shall remain the home state of the children. So by using the phrase remove and removal, we think that's what the judge meant, that the judge understood this to be a removal event rather than an initial custody event.
Correct. And at the outset of trial, I did correctly state forth that this was an initial custody determination. I did set that appropriate standard out at the beginning of the case.
Does it make any difference that in paragraph 3, the court starts off by saying, is in the best interest of the minor child to parties to be awarded joint legal custody, and in paragraph 5, the court says it is in the best interest of the minor children that the parties be awarded joint physical custody, but in paragraph 4, he starts out the defendant has failed to meet her burden?
I think it is certainly an issue within the order, yes, and I do not believe the order was necessarily clear in distinguishing between those items.
Before your time runs out, would you talk briefly about the assignment regarding specific findings?
Yes, of course, Your Honor. So by failing to comply with the mandatory requirements as set forth in section 43-2932, the district court's order here is such an instance where they did find that there was an abuse of discretion, or I'm sorry, that there was domestic abuse beyond a preponderance of the evidence. Because it made that finding, the court was required to make written findings, but it did not. And further, that statute also places the burden on appellee to show how the time awarded to him or requested by him would not cause any harm or conflict as it relates to the domestic violence and the other parent that was affected, as well as the children.
Did you make any kind of motion before taking an appeal asking for modification?
We did not
to make the findings you claim are missing.
We did not, Your Honor, because
does that matter to our analysis?
I do not believe it does, because no matter how you slice this case, the wrong the wrong decision was made, whether it's the lack of written findings, whether it's the analysis of the best interests, whether it's the burden that I believe was improperly imposed on Ms. Curtis. I believe that the district court erred in its findings.
If the district court didn't make specific findings and if we agreed with that, what is the result? If we side you on that issue, regard to domestic violence, what is the result? Do we send it back for the court to make findings?
I believe that the court could send it back, but I believe that because this is actually an issue of law, and this court can review independently of the lower court's determination, I believe that this court can simply reverse and make its own findings that then comport with the statutory requirements.
Then what does that do for you?
If only on the assignments of issue, if only on this assignment of error regarding the domestic violence, it would simply, any order would provide some security for my client and the minor children moving forward with visitations, exchange places, communication.
What about the existing parenting plan? Do you contend poses a danger to your client or the children?
Absolutely, considering that there were several instances of domestic violence discussed at the time of trial and the court did make that finding, but then nothing was done about it. I believe that without those specific findings, we simply don't know if there's enough protection there, and that's why that statute is so very important.
I beg your pardon. I think that what the statute is saying,
that's a problem.
I beg your pardon. I think what the statute is saying, that is under 43, 29, 30, 32, right, is that there are accommodation, once there's a finding of domestic abuse or intimate partner abuse, of which there is a finding and no cross appeal to dispute it, so that be the finding, that the parenting plan, it should make accommodations to ensure the safety of the other parent and the children. Doesn't the statute have some examples, perhaps, of the accommodations that should be in the parenting plan following such a finding? So are there any accommodations in this plan that reflect the finding in this case that there is intimate partner abuse? The trial judge wrote in his or her order, right, I looked at the statute, everything's okay. Is that enough?
No, Your Honor. The parenting plan does not even so much as mention the domestic violence or the finding of domestic violence, and provides no accommodations for the minor children or my client regarding the domestic violence.
Accommodations would include things like
the course
changing at the police station, or all communications must be in writing, or things of that nature.
The court is unfortunately not very specific. It just says special findings, but the statutory requisite doesn't provide us any specific examples.
And while we're all together this morning, what specific things do you contend were necessary for the safety of your client or the children that aren't already in the parenting plan?
I believe that things such as exchanges in public locations that have some sort of video camera system set up, communication through a parenting app, My Family Wizard, whatnot, communication via phone, unless absolutely necessary, none of that. Those types of accommodations, I think, would have provided at least some sort of protection for my client and these kids. And with that, I would conclude. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Ayers, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. I am Amber Ayers, and I am appearing with and on behalf of the appellee, Franklin Moscoso, in this case. This is a case where initial custody determination was the primary focus of the district court and needs to be the primary focus of this court. And I believe that the court's findings establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the decision to award joint legal and physical custody to both parties was in the best interest of the children. And going back to the first assignment of error on the issue of a burden of proof with the factors for removal, it is correct that at this point in time, the state of the law in Nebraska does not require removal jurisprudence on an initial paternity determination. And although we believe that it's not required to make the court's findings that the children should not have been removed to the state of Iowa, I think as you look through the court's prior jurisprudence with both Coleman and Shandera, that removal jurisprudence is important and should be applicable. I actually think that the state of the law in Nebraska currently has created an interesting dichotomy between husbands and fathers. And this case, I think, highlights that if you look at the actual testimony, my client, though not married to the appellant, they cohabitated while the children were young. They separated in approximately 2017, and at that time, through their own self-help measures, determined a joint physical and legal custodial arrangement where they were sharing a 2-2-3 parenting plan. So from the time that these parties separated, my client was exercising 50% of the parenting responsibilities and functions. And yet, because there was not a marriage license between these two parties, when the appellant told him she was moving the children to Iowa, he had no protections. He did file for custody, and he was at that time requesting sole legal and physical custody based on the understanding that the appellant intended to move the children to the state of Iowa away from him.
Neither party has assigned error to the determination that the custody, the physical custody, should be joined. Is that correct?
That is correct. And actually, I believe if you review the record that—
How can you have joint custody if they're residing in different places?
Well, and I think that's actually one of the more interesting parts of this case. My client was requesting primary physical custody if the appellant moved to Iowa. However, it was her own testimony at trial that if the court did not allow her to remove the children, she would remain in the state of Nebraska and she would be requesting the joint physical custodial arrangement to continue. So when you look through the factors that the court was determining, and I think the court did properly determine the factors, one of the guidance that the court can look to at best interest is how removal would impact the relationship between the custodial and non-custodial parent and the child. And if we look at the facts of this case, if the mother was allowed to move, she was asking that the father see the children every other weekend, did not even offer him extended summer parenting time, although he'd been exercising 50% of the time.
I would like to ask a question, if I may, with respect to physical custody and how that might work. So, can you hear me, madam?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're having technical difficulties galore here this morning. If there were joint physical custody and mom lived on the next block and dad lived on the next block and it was a low conflict separation, right? Then joint physical custody would be hopefully feasible. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Is there some kind of geographic known quantity by which joint physical becomes a legal impossibility? Somebody's in Council Bluffs, somebody's in Omaha, two different states, but alas, not far geographically.
Well, and I don't think there's a legal requirement, but I do think there's a functional requirement. And it's things like, can you take the children to and from their school? And can you get them to and from treating medical providers, activities in the area? And these parties, again, through their own decision prior to any judicial involvement, were exercising that joint physical custodial arrangement. And I would highlight for the court, and I think it's important this court understand, that there were no allegations of any improper behavior or any issues with the co-parenting from the point in time that these parties separated in 2017. Any reference to domestic violence occurred prior to 2017. Also, the record is void of any information where any sort of domestic violence was discussed between 2017 and trial in April of 2021. The district court entered a temporary order at that point in time. The appellant did not indicate that there were any concerns with domestic violence or an inability to co-parent. And
well, let me interrupt yet again, and I ask this question of opposing counsel. I believe there is a finding of intimate partner violence, right?
That is correct. Yes.
And you all did not cross appeal and say no such a thing. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Right. And there was some testimony that that if she were in fact a victim, she was ashamed, embarrassed, didn't want to share it until there was a separation and she came forward with other persons. So they say, right?
That is correct.
Let me proceed. So there is a finding of domestic violence. What is your view then on the adequacy of the trial judge's written findings as required by 432932?
Well, and I don't believe that the statute requires a specific written finding. And I think the court's referencing the statute is sufficient in that it indicates the parenting plan that the court entered comports with a specific finding that the parenting plan does protect both parties and the minor children.
Does this order say that, or does this order say there is a statute and it's designed to protect people? Well, I think we all agree that's the purpose of the statute. Were there anything specifically in the plan, such as those suggestions in the statute, which accommodations should be considered by the trial court having found intimate partner abuse? Or is there anything in the plan that you could say met those requirements or satisfied the safety of the other parent and children?
Well, and I think even just the exchange schedule, exchanging at 8 o'clock in the morning, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, allows the parent ending parenting time to drop off at school or daycare. And it was actually the testimony at trial that the appellee, my client, works early in the morning, and so he generally was not present on exchanges. And the testimony at trial, which I find interesting based on co-counsel's comments today, the appellee requested communication between the parties occur in writing because there had been miscommunications. His testimony was he'd asked for communication in writing because they would discuss something and 2 or 3 days later, the appellant would forget that they'd had that discussion. So he-
I see. Asking, was there consideration done for perhaps the parenting wizard or some other mechanism that would not only record accurately, but could measure the level of conflict?
I don't believe that there were suggestions by either party that that was necessary. And again, the protections to guarantee the appellant offered no suggestions outside of the terms and conditions of the parenting plan. And so I don't believe that there's a fallacy or there's anything lacking in the court's order that needs to be changed.
So are you telling us that based on what happened at trial and the specific requests that the parties made of the district court, that there was nothing requested by the defendant to be included in the parenting plan other than the custodial arrangement that wasn't included.
That's correct. And that's why I believe that the order is not insufficient as it relates to section 432932.
We've been talking a little bit about the vernacular of removal and the proper burden of proof that applies if removal is queued up in one sense or in another sense. In this case, the defendant's answer specifically prayed for permission to remove the children from the state of Nebraska. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So is it possible that when the decree, when the judge's order addressed removal, it was simply addressing the specific request made in the pleadings?
That is correct. And again, I don't believe that there's anything in the order that shows that an improper or heightened burden was placed upon the defendant at trial. And I believe that on its face, even if we're just looking at the issue of the relationship between the parties, if the defendant had been allowed to remove the children, it would impact negatively the relationship between the father and his children. However, the defendant's own response at trial was if she was not allowed to remove, then she would remain in the Omaha area and they would continue the joint physical schedule that they'd been exercising since 2017, which would leave the children in the same status with the same relationship to both parents.
So do you believe that as a matter of law that the mother had a burden, not merely of persuasion, but a greater burden to demonstrate the propriety of removal in this matter, which you all seem to agree is an initial event?
I do not. I believe that removal jurisprudence is important, and I believe that akin to Coleman, those factors can be reviewed by the district court. However, I think the order would have been as sufficient had the court stated that the plaintiff had met his burden and removal is not in the children's best interest, simply that the best interest of the children was to remain in Omaha. So I think that the court used language that said that the defendant had failed to meet her burden, but I think we end up with the same result if the court had simply said that the plaintiff did meet his burden.
I think Ms. Ayers, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your time and effort. Mr. Bailiff, do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Moscoso versus Curtis. You are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Owlewski versus Madison County Commissioners.